It's Wednesday night. Welcome again to the class on presenting the past. Hi there, Fran. Let's begin as we normally do. We'll start off with a short breathing meditation. Then I'll do the visualization of the Buddha and we'll take refuge and generate a mind of enlightenment. So just get comfortable in the seat. Allow your back to be straight and shoulders relaxed. And as you continue to breathe normally and naturally, allow yourself to feel the expansion of the abdomen or upper chest whenever you inhale. And then just notice what happens when you exhale. So your attention is focused upon the body and you are noticing the movements that take place when you inhale and exhale. Just allowing everything to slow down, so that the body and the mind can be relaxed. And the mind is gently focused. And you're breathing normally and naturally. In fact, it seems as if the body is breathing itself. And as you're breathing normally and naturally and feeling relaxed in your seat, imagine that in the space above you appears Shakyamuni Buddha and the refuge field of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and the other teachers. Surrounding you on seats are all sentient beings. And recollecting that every one of us wishes to avoid suffering and wish to be happy, yet lack genuine happiness. Think that you have decided to lead all the beings surrounding you. In the goal of accomplishing genuine happiness. And the way you've chosen to do that is to take refuge in the Buddha above you, above all of us, in his community of the Bodhisattvas and other enlightened beings, and in the teachings themselves. So, if you'd like to just recite along with me, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. But in response to this wish, lights of nectar stream from the heart of the Buddha and wash over you. And they remove all the hindrances and obstacles to your wishes. And you look around you and see that all the others, everyone else is still suffering. And this is primarily because none of them have developed love or compassion or joy or equanimity in a vast way. I think that you want to establish them into these four boundless states. And they all sentient beings have love and its causes. May they all be happy. May they all be free from suffering and its causes. May they all abide in a state of joy. And may they all be free of aversion and desirous attachment. May they abide in a state of equanimity. You're going to establish them in those four states. And with that intention, again, our lights and nectars pour forth from the heart of the Buddha and they wash over you and everyone surrounding you. And you find yourself established within those states. Now see yourself prostrating before the refuge field, making offerings. And in confessing or laying down the burden of past unskillful action. And rejoicing that you've done so in the kindness of others. Request that the Buddhas and the teachings remain forever. And then dedicate this activity that you've just engaged in towards achieving enlightenment for yourself and for others. To let go of any sort of clinging we might have to ourselves as being special or that what we're doing is special in any way, we're going to make an offering of a mandala, which is a world system, as a means to counteract the clinging that we have to ourselves, our bodies, and our ideas. Would you like to recite along with me? This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine that this is a Buddha field and offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Atta Mandala Kamariyatayami. We release the offering. It's been accepted by the Buddha and he smiles at us with delight. And you look up into his face, looking into his eyes. And you feel accepted and at ease. Now an emanation leaves the heart of the Buddha, moves through space, comes to the bite above the crown of your head, facing the same direction you are. This emanation descends, entering your skull, coming down, down, down to the level of your heart. Then the radiance of his body begins to expand, filling your body and mind. Now, light streams forth through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space. And wherever there are beings existing within space, think that you've woken them up, brought them into the fully awakened state of enlightenment. And there's no difference between the self and anyone else. In fact, ideas of self and other have vanished. Light begins to withdraw, re-enters your heart. You feel yourself embodied, and you're sitting on the chair you're in. You're breathing normally and naturally. You recollect this was all on your level of imagination. But nevertheless, you've placed an imprint upon your mind to engage in the activity of a fully awakened being. And with that, you breathe in deeply through your nostrils, Exhale through your mouth and allow yourself to find yourself present on your seat. Breathing normally and naturally, your eyes are open and you're in front of your screen. So once again, welcome to the class. This is class 4.
Eddie, could you...
Okay, so let's have a look at what we did last week. Does that sound a bit better, Miffy? Let's look at what we covered. We first looked at some Buddhist history in India and Tibet and here at the centre in Brisbane. We looked at how Atisha's lamp is the foundation for all the different graduated stages of the path material that all the Tibetan Buddhist traditions share. And we look at sort of the history of the Buddha himself expressed in 12 deeds. And this was not like a normal Western type style history. It's a hagiography, meaning it's a teaching device, a teaching learning device. And we also saw how we needed to listen to these teachings. So there are skillful ways to listen and unskillful ways to listen. And so these were described in the three cups. And then it was also suggested that when we listen, we think of ourselves as being like sick or a patient, and that we are seeking recovery. So we're going to see the doctor, who is the teacher, and that we were to listen with respect and actually take the medicine of the teacher. And then last week, we looked at this outline of the foundation of all good qualities. We saw there that it was in total 14 verses, that the text itself had sort of three parts, a beginning, a middle, and an end. The beginning were called preliminary practices, and there were like two verses in there. And then the middle, like these 10 verses, at the very end of the last two verses of conclusion. And these teachings are really talking about the three capacities for spiritual practice. Now, there's not all that many, put it this way, there's not as many texts with commentaries on this practice as there are of many others. But so I've been able to find these ones here. So of these three of them definitely give you a commentary on the foundation of all good qualities. So they are in the store of liberation here. Lama Tsongkhapa is preparing for Tantra. And then this top one here with the tree on it by Geshe Sopa. So they are three books with direct commentaries. The other two books by the Dalai Lama and Venerable Thupten Chodron are used to support the commentaries. Now, today our teaching is still going to be based around these foundation of all good qualities, but we're going to look in more detail at the practices of the small scope and the practices of the middle scope. And so what I'm going to do is like show you like a couple of slides that you would have seen last week. And in those slides, now we looked at the aim and the practices of each scope and what the practices eliminated. So we're going to put those back up again, but then we're going to look at the process of elimination that takes place, which are the stages of the path. And at the end of that process, then we briefly review it again with the slide you are familiar with. So let's have a look at the first slide. So this is one you saw last week. It describes the initial level of the practitioner. So you know that their direct aim was to have a fortunate rebirth. And what they had to practice was to pacify coarse, harmful thoughts, words, and deeds. In other words, abandon the 10 non-virtues and practice the 10 virtues. So here we have the abandonment of the 10 non-virtues, and then you have to pick up the 10 virtues. So this is the goal, their aim, what they do, what they have to do, and what they should not do. But to have this direct aim, there are things you need to contemplate first. So what we'll look at now is those different topics that we contemplate before we come to this decision that, wow, I must make sure I have a fortunate rebirth and not an unfortunate rebirth. And this begins with verse 3 in this foundation of all the qualities. So let's look at what that says. So here you can see Lama Tsongkhapa saying, this life is as impermanent as a water bubble. Remember how quickly it decays and death comes. After death, just like the shadow follows the body, the results of black and white karma follow. Now, what I guess, first of all, the essential point being made in this verse is that we have to avoid the Lama Tsongkhapa, the meaningless thought to just strive for the comfort of this life. Because as it says here, death comes quickly. And what you've done in this life, the deeds, they produce results in your next life. So it's, and this is like this, these are the beginning verses for, like you said, the person of smallest scope. The person who's aiming for in their next life after death to take rebirth again in the high realm. So the first top, so we've got this one here, so we're talking about this taking advantage of the leisure and opportunity you've got, which we looked at last week in detail. But we have to think about how quickly it can vanish and death appears. So there's three points that we need to remember. The death is certain. There's no avoidance of death. Its time is uncertain. And finally, of course, that only Dharma practice helps at the time of death. And this, the Dharma practice that actually helps is what they call a pure Dharma practice. Pure Dharma. So why is it pure? Why am I saying this using the word pure? Because purity connotes a spiritual goal. So we must, our practice has to be aimed at this fortunate human rebirth or liberation or enlightenment. That's what makes it Dharma. If it's aimed at this life, it's not Dharma.
So, Eddie, for if someone is new to this presentation of the three main points, death is certain, the time of death is uncertain, in a way this is like counterintuitive to how we live our whole life, where we don't want to think about death and we're pretty certain that we're not going to die soon. You know? So even if intellectually we get it, actually what how we emotionally function isn't according to these three at all.
No, well, probably maybe we should have a war here, like overseas. That might wake us up. Yeah, so it goes against this, like I say, with you, this sort of negligence on our part. Our unwillingness to look at whatever we do in this life, this life will always come to an end. And we don't know when that will be. And like I said, so with this, we've got to say that, you might think, well, so what? Mm-hmm. Well, that wouldn't be so bad if when we died, there was absolutely nothing to experience.
Mm. Yeah, because I've just been reading, there's a lot of people that had near-death experiences with the floods, you know, right here in our backyard. And it's a big shock to think, oh, wow, this could be my last few hours on earth. That's actually what they were saying.
Yeah, that very well could have been, no. For some it was. So this, like I said, this lifetime could come to an end at any time. So we need to practice Dharma. Now, remember what the word Dharma means. It means that which holds me back from suffering. So I've got to hold myself back from suffering. Now, death is certain, and yet we're saying, yeah, it is. We can't avoid it. But yet we've got to have something to stop ourselves from suffering right at the time of death, and particularly for what happens after death.
So Ravi's asking, how does the Dharma lessen our fear of death?
Well, it's coming up, Ravi, but I can say this. If you're really like honest about life and death, right, you're going to say to yourself, well, I don't really know for certain whether there is something after death. And you can say, yep, that's right. I really don't know. So you're saying when you say that I don't know whether there's something or nothing. If you say, well, if I choose, there's nothing to fear, you go, well, I think there is nothing after death. Well, you can say if you think that, you won't experience it. You cannot experience nothing. So that's not going to happen. Then the other side is, well, suppose there is something. Wouldn't it be better to be ready for that? But you could say, well, why should I be afraid? Because you don't know what's going to happen. It could be wonderful, or it could be absolutely terrible. You just don't know. But it's like, so we're going to a place, we're going to take a journey into the unknown. It's like to say, have you ever been to Siberia, Ravi? Or have you ever been some place that you've heard of, but you don't know very much about it? So it's like, okay, so when you go, wouldn't you like to be like ready? And so we say, the smart person would say, yeah, of course I'd like to be ready for my journey. So we say, well, this is a journey where things are going to be radically different. They're not going to be like they are, like this life we've got. It's going to be really strange.
So Jenny's asking, does it come down to our belief about rebirth, this death contemplation, or not?
Well, like I said, it's either nothing or something. Now, if it's something, then we can look at what might that something be? Well, there's going to be this thing called death that we have experienced many times before, but we've forgotten because we're living right now. But there's going to be a time somebody's going to declare us dead. So we're going to ask ourselves, why would there not be a continuation of consciousness? So Jenny, you've got to ask yourself is, why, if I think there's no rebirth or there's nothing after the point of death, why do I think that?
So Jenny's kind of saying, for want of better terminology, death of the physical body, but not death of the soul or the mind.
Yeah, that's right. So, so they're going to say, it's like, so we've got to ask ourselves, well, if I'm thinking the body will be here, of course, as all bodies are left and as we know, right? And we go, okay, so what's going on? Well, we might say, well, it's the soul that goes on, or it's consciousness that goes on. So we've got to ask ourselves a few more questions about that.
Even Eddie can, I mean, the body dies, but it doesn't disappear. It's still there. Right. It still has a continuum.
For quite some time, isn't it?
Yeah, so then the mind also separates from the body, but it's still there functioning.
Yeah, except the experiences of it are quite different. Because, like before, while we were alive, the body supports the mind, doesn't it? But now the body is no longer functioning. So the experiences of the mind are going to be very different than what they were when the body was functioning. They're not going to be the same. So this is why we need to have Dharma. It's like, well, what do I do when I have an experience like I don't know what it's going to be like, really.
So Jenny's saying, so then Dharma is like the training of the mind.
Yeah, and we've got to train ourselves now. So we get ready for this journey. Now we get ready now. And so as we approach death, we're not afraid of it. And when we actually engage in the journey, the death journey, or the journey between this life and the next, we're not afraid. Because it's not that we die and then suddenly we find ourselves, hello, here I am in some new body, you know, like another human again or something. It's going to be some sort of shocking sort of process for us. So Dharma is to prepare us for that journey so it's not so shocking.
The transition.
Yeah, the transition period. It's as if you're saying, you're like, well, I'm going to go to China. You say, well, how are you going to go? You say, well, I'm going to take a boat. And then you know, well, okay, when you go on a boat, it's going to be a long journey. What have you got to take on your journey? How are you going to prepare? What are you going to do before you get to China? There's a similar type of thing here. So how am I going to prepare for this new life?
So, Eddie, some of us prepare very badly for a trip.
Sure they do. That's right. So don't do it now. You get the same result. Okay, so now we're going to say, okay, so we're going to take this journey. And so in some classes, there's a presentation of the journey itself. And then there's the arrival. So in this class, we're not going to talk about the journey, but we're going to talk about the arrival point. And the arrival points are of only two kinds. One, it's a great place you've got to. The other, it's terrible. So you want to know as much as you possibly can about the terrible place so you don't go there. Which leads us to the next topic. Why meditate on the lower realms? So the lower realms are something, you know, there's terrible, hellish, all they are realms of immense suffering where you can't do anything like you can do now. You don't have very much control over your mind. So there's a lot of emphasis put on meditating on the lower realms, and often these meditations are uncomfortable, and many people find, like, I don't believe this. And, you know, the legitimate question should be, why are we doing this? Why are you telling me about all these terrible and horrible experiences that animals can experience, that spirits can experience, and these different beings in these terrible realms can experience? Why? It's not comfortable. And this is the reason. To know what to expect. Because if you know what to expect, you'll do everything you can to avoid that place. So we find out about it as much as we can now while we're living beings with intelligence and a good mind and a comfortable situation to think about it. And we're kind of like, well, how would I get there? What do I have to do to get there? And then you find out what you need to do. And then go, well, I'm not doing it. And if I don't do that, then I won't be there. I'll end up in the better place. And like, where is the better place for you? Well, it's to be reborn, as you said, your aim was for a fortunate human rebirth. That's where you're going. So you don't want to end up like in jail. You don't want to end up in the worst place, the place you didn't set out to go to. So you make sure you get on the right plane, you make sure you get on the right boat, you've got your passport, you've got your tickets, you've paid. So this is the first thing we need to avoid And this is called the small renunciation of the person of small capacity. We are renouncing or abandoning the causes and processes to end up here.
Eddie, so that's quite different from just kind of freaking out emotionally and shutting down when you hear about these states.
Yeah, well, freaking out and shutting down emotionally doesn't help you avoid it.
Ah.
So, as you know, if you see, like, for instance, with these floods, if you see a large wall of water coming towards you, well, yeah, you could well freak out, but it's not a good idea to freeze. Freaking out is to go, shit, I got to avoid that water. Right? I got to get up into the ceiling and up on the roof. So this is to inspire an action of yours. And the action you want to take is to take a refuge from it. Right? So refuge, once again, the Dharma is your refuge. This is one of the major causes for you to take refuge in the Dharma, because the Dharma is the method whereby you can avoid this type of result. So which is just, of course, the next stage of our journey. So the question is oftentimes saying, why we're studying these lower realms, it's really uncomfortable. Sometimes it goes on and on and on, like I said, so that we know what to expect and to become terrified of that and act on our terror. And the action we're required is to take refuge.
So Jenny's just asking, knowing about the lower realms will then shape our karma and our actions of this life
to avoid stop that in the future. That's right, that's right. It's like that thing, like, I don't know if it ever happened to you, but being a boy growing up, like one that, my mother in particular would always tell me, like, don't steal things. And as a kid growing up, and if you don't have what other kids got and you want what they've got, you sort of think about stealing it. And the thing is, like, so why should I not steal it? Other than the fact that mum is telling me not to take it. However, if it's different, if your dad goes, this is why, son, takes you up to the cop shop and puts you in there, and there's some drunken guy locked up in a cell or something, and then your dad has a talk with the copper, and the copper just grabs you and gives you a good shake up and says, you do anything bad, but this is where you're going to end up, son. It freaks you out, doesn't it?
I could just see this.
I was thinking of taking the comic books, but now I'm not going to. So I'm terrified of the policeman and the jail cell and the drunk. You go, there's no way I want to be in there. And that's the point of these meditations. Right? I was telling Miffy the other day. I watched a story about a man who spent about 20 years in the drug business. And the last question, the interviewer, I said to him, "So, do you have anything else you'd like to say to the audience?" And he said, "Listen to your mum and dad. Listen to your mother and father." I cracked up on it. That's what it comes down to.
A big, tough criminal.
Yeah.
So Mandy says that she did that to her son after he stole something.
Yeah.
And it was a good deterrent.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember another student of ours, her son started getting involved in drugs, and she got in touch with the police, so they came around to their home and had a talk with him. And he just straightened up immediately after that. And this is the idea behind these topics, right? For us to straighten up.
Right. So it is really to do with protection. It's nothing to do with guilt or judgment or anything, but really to protect us from disaster.
We either protect ourselves or we don't. And there's outcomes for either side. If you protect yourself, you're safe. If you don't, you could be in a world of hell, right? Terrible things can happen to you. Because remember here, it's not, you know, it's just like this life. You think about it, you think how much control you've got over this life. And often we think we've got quite a lot of control. Then the floods come. Then the fires come. Then a war comes. And you go like, oh, hello, I guess I didn't have all that much control over it anyway. And it's the same sort of thing when you get to the death. You know, you if you don't think about the stuff and try and get some control over it now, you won't have any control then.
And that's the last time, that's the last place that we want to be panicking is right then.
Yeah, and you won't, like it's too late. You know, like you're in the flood, you're in the fire. The shells are coming through the room. You know, you can only respond then. So we don't want that. But now, like I said, so this is all taking place. It's just cause and effect. These effects are coming about because you've put in place the causes for them and they've met the right conditions. And so now you get the effect. It's a state of mind that is terrified of the sufferings of the lower realms. So that is one of the two causes that produce the effect of going for refuge to the three jewels. So if you can ask, well, what's the other cause here? You say, confidence that I'll be protected. The confidence that I can protect myself. And you say, well, why is, what makes you so confident you can? Because you say, the essence of refuge is to work in accordance with karma, cause and effect. That's how you take refuge. That produces your own refuge. And this is really the law that karma refers to. So this is from Nagarjuna, and you know, the great scholar, meditator, compiler. And he says, all sufferings are the result of unwholesome actions. So likewise are all bad rebirths. The pleasure enjoyed throughout our lives and all happy rebirths are the result of virtue. So this is great for us, though. We're just going to, okay, that's what I've got to adopt. As I live my life, in this life, while I'm alive, it's got to be one of virtue, and especially at the time of death. At the time of death, I want virtuous thoughts to be driving everything. Even if I'm lying in the bed, I can't think very clearly. I'd like to have a picture of the Dalai Lama in front of me or the guru that I trusted, some refuge object so that my mind can be drawn to it and I have good thoughts. I'm not afraid. At minimum, you know, you can have something as simple as that, something that you trust in. Other than that, throughout your life, you try and live the best life you can. You know what non-virtuous activities of bodies are, of the body? Don't do it. You know the four non-virtuous activities of speech? Don't do them. Do the opposite. And it's the same with the mind. So karma, as you know, it means action. So we've got the actions of the mind, we've got the actions of speech, and we've got the actions of the body. And these actions are causes. Like you do an action, you carry one out, and it stops. That's the cause for some sort of result. But every action of body, speech, or mind will produce a result, unless you deliberately interfere with it. So I'll just say here, so like the good results that we're seeking through our actions of body and speech and mind can be undermined very quickly by anger. But anger too, that can also be undermined. The result of anger can be undermined by us going, oh my gosh, this has caused so many problems for myself and others. I'm going to make a promise not to be angry again. And I'm going to try and find as much as I can about anger and what causes it and not be angry. I'm going to generate more kindness towards others, and that way I'll be more kind to myself. Now, when we carry out these actions, like I said, they produce results. The results rarely take place immediately. Or else we could get a pretty immediate result, but there's other results that could follow on.
yeah, we wouldn't be so confused if the results correlated, you know, were really next to the cause. We could put it together so much easier.
Yeah. So these actions, they leave imprints on the mind. And these imprints are called, you know, there's another term from called a seed. It means it leaves the potential to experience some sort of result in the future. In other words, as we're going, as we're, you know, imagine yourself, you are dying, and you've got all this potential on your mind to be either virtuous or non-virtuous, to be really upset or calm. And you have to control the process. And it's going to be very hard to do if you haven't done it before. So we try and do as much as we can now, so we're quite familiar with the process. And in fact, many ways you could look at, if you've done this well while you're alive, come the time of death, you could say, look, I'm dying without any regrets. I have no regrets about my life. Because when I became a Buddhist, I understood that to take refuge meant act in accordance with karma, cause and effect. I understood it. I've been trying to do that ever since I found out about it. So now I look back. Sure, I haven't practiced well enough to become enlightened or to be liberated, but I can assure you I will not be taking the lower realm rebirth. I have nothing to regret about the life I've led. I can die peacefully, a sense of joy. Well, that's our minimum. We've got to get to that stage. Now, like I said, so these actions that we can engage in, and as we're talking about the initial level of practice, right, the small scope. So the level of renunciation here that we're trying to make sure that we can accomplish is to not end up in the lower realms. That's all we've got to do. Make sure we don't get into lower realms, take upper realm rebirth as a human being again. That's our goal here. Now, so what I want to talk to you now about what is the type of action you could do that could put you into the lower realms. So it's one you want to avoid, in other words. So let's say, for instance, that you, as we all have done, I'm sure, we've all killed different types of living beings. And then we know, okay, my gosh, if I die and I die angry, this could spear me into the lower realm rebirth. So he goes, okay, so I've got to avoid that for sure. And suppose you are able to, because you die with a virtuous mind at the time of death. Now, it is the case that people who behave very badly in many different ways throughout life, at the time of death, can have regret for it. And they could die peacefully. They might die thinking of their mother who was so kind to them. But that's a virtuous mindset. So dying with that type of mindset, you avoid the lower realm rebirth, you get rebirth as a human being, but because of all those terrible actions you did in the past, this is going to have an impact on your life as a human being. So I'm going to show you some of the impacts the activities of killing can play out in the life you have as a human being. The point of doing this, of course, is once again to either avoid the act of killing or acknowledge that you have done and purify the effect of it. So here we have a picture of the human being. So remember here, this is a person who's killed a number of different times. They've avoided lower realm rebirth. They've taken rebirth as a human being. But in the life of a human being, they run into all sorts of dangers. Like life is threatening. But you can, you know, if you look at what's happening in the Ukraine, right? So they are all human beings, but they're all being threatened with death. And this is like I'm saying, so like, if you look at countless lives, you've killed countless beings. So you experience it in your life as a human being. You find yourself, your environment is one full of strife. And what's possible is that you could die in it. So just recently now we saw, there was a story on the news, a woman gave birth to a young child in the Ukraine. The mother died. Yeah, the birth was successful, but very shortly after, the mother died. She was only in her 30s, and the baby died too. So this is, from a Buddhist perspective, these are outcomes of past unskillful karmic acts, including killing. The other thing is that you have the propensity to repeat the behavior. So of course, the karmic habit.
So, Eddie, you're really painting like a vicious circle here, because, of course, many times when disasters happen to us, like when we're in an environment where people are trying to take our life or people trying to take our stuff, then we, in the short term, end up doing exactly that same thing and perpetuating the cycle all the way while trying to make it better for ourselves. We're making it worse.
That's right. That's because we don't understand karma. That's all because of karma. We just don't understand it, or we don't know about it, or we don't act in accordance with what we understand. So now this brings us to the end of the section on the initial level of practitioner. So just as a quick sort of rewind overview. So to decide to aim for a fortunate human rebirth, the meditations that you need to engage in to get that type of motivation are these ones. Know what it is to have a precious human rebirth, life, death and impermanence, and unfortunate rebirth. And so you aim for, you want the precious human life. You know that being a human being, you age, you get sick, you are impermanent, you will die at some stage in it. And then, once again, you face another rebirth. You do not want to end up having an unfortunate rebirth. So you are aiming to not have that take place. Your motivation is higher realm rebirth, fortunate rebirth. That's what I'm aiming for. Very minimum of this life and as a spiritual practitioner. How do I actually achieve it? Take refuge in the three jewels. Observe the law of karma and its effects. So in summarizing this, we have another verse by Lama Tsongkhapa, and he says, finding firm and definite conviction in this, meaning the laws of karma, please bless me always to be careful to abandon even the slightest negativities and accomplish all virtuous deeds. In other words, please inspire me through the teachings I've listened to and engaged in to always be careful in the practice of avoiding these 10 non-virtuous actions and observing the 10 virtuous ones. So instead of killing, saving life. Instead of stealing, being generous. Instead of sexual misconduct, encouraging people, helping them to maintain relationships, maintaining their own. Now, instead of harsh speech, gentle speech. Instead of lying, truth speaking, and so forth. So each one's an opposite. Because you know the outcomes. Right? So this is not being enforced on us, right? There's no one saying you're a bad person if you don't do this. What happens is you get bad results if you do bad behaviors. This is cause and effect. You do good stuff happens. Okay, so now we come to, so let me just have a little pause, just for a few minutes. Is there anything anybody would like to ask or say or just bring up?
I'll just give people a moment to type into the chat, but also, so, avoiding doing the really negative things, is that enough if we can't do the positive things that we can't get out that much or whatever, or do we need both sides?
Both sides. You need both sides. So this presentation so far is okay. It's quite concise, but I've tried to sort of aim it at, so just keep to the point sort of thing.
Jenny's just saying, wow, that is hard work.
Pick the big things that you notice. Right? So if you know you obviously swear a lot or you bicker a lot, or you know, you just go through the things and say, which ones do I do mostly? Okay, that's the one I've got to work against. And I've got to do its opposite.
Ravi's got a question. Is karma directly observable or only inferred? And I mean, I'd also ask, like, what's the time lag?
We can't say with any definitiveness, because it all depends on you. You know, you're in charge of the show.
But can we directly observe karmic cause and effect in action, or can we only infer it?
You have to infer it. At this level where you are now, for us, where we are, it's all inference. However, it is possible to develop your mind to a stage where it can be sort of seen quite straight ahead. It becomes much more obvious, right? But at the level we're at, it's not.
So is this like if we don't know anything about nutrition and we just eat what we want to eat or what we crave or feel like eating or can get our hands on, and then someone says, no, you've got to eat blah, blah, blah. It's like, what?
Yes. So generally, yes, it can. The repeat behavior can be changed by Dharma. It's the same way that an addict engages in repeat behaviors. Addiction can be stopped. But you also know about addiction is you have to stop it. It doesn't matter how much help you get from others and encouragement, you have to stop it. And as anyone who's ever been an addict knows how difficult that is. That's not easy. Fran? Yeah. So Fran has put up about karma, you know. So one of the things, like you could say, like, but this is an inference. So Ravi, I think you might have asked about whether it's straight ahead or infer. You can infer that you've been a moral and ethical person because here you are as a human being with the leisure and opportunity to engage in Dharma. Those were the causes that produced this result. And as Fran pointed out, if you know where you want to be, where you're going to be in the future, just look at what you're doing now. And remember that while you're alive, and if you look at the karma, you can alter it. That's just that we're not locked in here. It's not karma's not deterministic. So we're going next to the level of the middling practitioner or the medium practitioner. Now, this person too, their major goal here is a liberation, just like the lower person was a liberation from they want freedom from the lower realms. Like, you know, you're not in one now, you want to make sure you're not in one in the future. The person at the middle level goes, not only do I not want to take rebirth in the lower realms, I don't want to take rebirth in samsara at all. So you go, okay, that's just the next level up. So let's have a look at what they're aiming for, what they practice, and what they have to eliminate. So I said, like, their aim is this liberation, the state of freedom from an uncontrolled rebirth. In fact, they don't take rebirth again within cyclic existence. It's called nirvana in the Sanskrit and nibbana in the Pali. And the state of liberation here means that they are free or liberated from the causes that produce cyclic existence. They liberate themselves from that. So how are they going to liberate themselves from it? Well, they engage in this practice called the three higher trainings. And the trainings are of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. That's what's going to produce the liberation that they're aiming at.
And Eddie, this liberation, this is irreversible. It's not a temporary thing.
It's not a temporary thing. That's right. Once you free yourself from the causes don't come back.
Yeah. Okay.
You cannot experience those effects anymore. So this is, you put up with it. So if you ask, it's not a temporary thing, and you say, no, it's not. You go, okay, so what do they have to eliminate? What do they have to get rid of so that it is final? This liberation is a final freedom. Well, they have to get rid of what they call the afflictive obscurations. So here I'll put down beneath it afflictions and their seeds, and also this what they call the polluted karma causing the rebirth in samsara. So we saw before that it's our actions, our karmas, that produce rebirth in the lower realms, but karma also produces rebirth in the higher realms, like rebirth as a human being with leisure and opportunity. So that's called, it's still karma, it's polluted karma, because we're still in cyclic existence. We're still experiencing all sorts of sufferings.
So it's still, say, good karma, but polluted because...
It's good in the sense that you have the freedom and opportunity to engage in a spiritual path to get you out. That's good.
Okay, but it's
while
polluted.
You're in, it's not so good.
Yeah.
And the things that keep us in are what they call afflictive obscurations or afflictions. So basically these afflictions or afflictive obscurations are what you could also call the disturbing emotions of hatred, greed, lust, anger, resentment, all those things. And they're all driven by ignorance, self-grasping ignorance. In other words, because we don't know how we actually exist and how the world around us exists, we don't know. We just find ourselves, so we do the best we can. But doing the best we can sort of keeps you here in cyclic existence or puts you in a worse place at the lower realms of cyclic existence. Mm. So we're going to look at now these different practices that they engage in. More than that, is we're sort of going to look at really these afflictive obscurations. We're going to look at what keeps us here first and then what we actually do. And then once again, we'll come to another slide like this. It's just a review. So afflictive obscurations, let's have a look. So an afflictive obscuration is always rooted in a delusion. So in other words, if we're angry, its root is delusion. It's a sense of confusion in someone. We're confused about something. If we find that we've got a great deal of desire towards a person or an object, again, it's rooted in a delusion. And so in other words, every affliction is rooted in delusion. So let's have a look at how they define a delusion. It is a mental factor that arises from inappropriate attention. And doing so, its function is to make the mind unpeaceful and uncontrolled. Now, this is a general definition which applies to all of the afflictions. That's why I've put this one up. So it's saying that an obscuring affliction is an inner mental event whose nature is to disturb or unsettle the mental state. Its function is to create a sort of a restless mind, a mind that's lost its equilibrium. So if you look at any of the disturbing emotions, you'll find that's what's going on, like it's an internal state. And the mind has lost its equilibrium. It's no longer at peace with itself. So the disturbing emotions aren't karmas. The afflictions aren't karma, but they produce the karma. They drive an activity. So from the unsettled state of mind, you do something. You either go towards the object or you retreat from it. So you have aversion or desire. And of course, when we engage in those actions, we don't really know what they're going to produce. But we don't know the outcomes of them. Oftentimes we think we do. And then we find we're very mistaken about it. Right? Oftentimes it's a heck of a lot worse than what we thought, or it's nothing as bad as what we thought it would be. But either way, it doesn't give you what you thought you'd get. Because what we want is happiness, authentic, stable happiness. Delusions can't provide that. Afflictions can't provide that. So in response to the affliction, an action takes place. So here's just what you were saying before, Mifflin, right? And I think one of the other students was saying too, is so that, you know, we meet up, we find ourselves in circumstances and we're required to act. But the act that we engage in, driven by affliction, produces a result we didn't expect. So here I've put the soldier up because of the Ukrainian crisis that's going on, right? And there's people out there killing other people to save lives. But actually what they're doing is doing terrible things to themselves and to the people that they're trying to kill. And that's why I've got death on this guy's shoulder, saying, you're taking life. And then we know the outcome. So we say, okay, even if you die with a virtuous mind thinking of your mum, in the next rebirth, a lot of fear. You could find yourself in some, you could find yourself killing again. There are all these other outcomes of your action.
So, Eddie, this is so complicated and convoluted because it's kind of like damned if you do and damned if you don't. What do you do in these situations where there's actually nothing constructive you can do at all?
Yeah, there's constructive you can do. There are people in every war that have gone, I'm not going to do it. Put me in jail, but I'm not going to go and kill people.
Or they're the ones that go and save the people from the rubble.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, okay. That story we saw about that fellow who went to war and got the
Hacksaw Ridge.
Yeah. Wow. There's plenty you can do, but often what you don't do it because you are overwhelmed by the media, by your society, by what everybody else is doing. You follow along. It's very hard to go against the general way that society behaves. And as I think one of the other students pointed out, it's very hard to go against your inner way of being. That's why it's so important to study this material.
So there's a question here from Ravi. What actually is inappropriate attention? Where should your attention be? Yeah.
Inappropriate attention means that your attention is placed on an object in a wrong way. Now, and it has subtle aspects and gross aspects.
So it's not so much the object, it's the way our attention
is relating to the object. That's right. So in terms of subtle inappropriate attention, your mind is focused on the object and thinks that object is existing in the way it appears to me. It has an inherent existence, but the mind is grasping at that appearance to be truly existent. That's the subtle inappropriate attention. That mind is wrong. But arising next from it is what they call the gross inappropriate attention, where it will seem like in this instance here, the person is aiming at somebody and in their mind is, this person is a threatening person to me and my country. At that time, so that's all they see, right? That gives them the right to go bang and shoot them. What they don't see at that time is this person is the son of a mother. This person's life is as important to them as mine is to me. all of those things get locked out. They cannot appear while you see the person as being an enemy. So now only enemy appears, only the bad appears. But the person doesn't exist like that. So that's why the attention is inappropriate, Robin. And it leads into things like killing, aggressiveness. But as I said, you know, the Buddha has said this, every person who's ever gone to the spiritual oasis, hate is never, ever overcome by hate, ever. It's always overcome by love. And yet, so we work against this deep knowledge.
So read this out.
Happiness and security can never be achieved through aggression and war. Yeah, it's like those, you know, so many times when we find women being bashed, you know, and what do the guys say? But I love you. like I love you, so cop that. But it's like, hang on a minute. So it's like, you know, I love my country, so I'm going to kill for it. And that's, you know, like I said, we are beings who are afflicted by great ignorance. So one of those ignorances is the effects of karma, the effects of our actions. We don't know what they are.
Okay, you've only got about...
So we have killed, we have stolen, we've done all these inappropriate behaviours that are going to cause us suffering. We say, well, what can I do so I don't experience the effect? Because there is something you can do. You can oppose these activities. And you can oppose them in a couple of different ways. This is the way you can oppose them when you're at home and the persons and all the suffers are out there, because really karma and affliction is about your own mental states. The suffering's not coming from out there. So let's look at this. So we know that when we have an action, there's going to be an effect to that action. And those effects will produce... So those actions will produce experiences which are very much like the causes. So we have this experience like the cause. How do we oppose it? Through remorse. And the remorse is not guided, it's not aimed at us, it's aimed at the action you did. So for instance, in the killing, you've killed something. You have great remorse for that. Like why? What's the remorse for? Well, you might be very sorry for the other person who lost their life. Of course, that's part of remorse. But the thing is, having that remorse will prevent you having an experience where your life has cut off shortly. Now, the throwing karma is what actually puts you into the realm that you find yourself in. Now, most times, if you die and the mind is negative, of course, you get the lower realm result. So you've got to put something in place to stop that. And these are the different remedies you could come up with. Like one of them might be forgiveness, saying sorry. Others might be making donations. Other things you can do are read sutras. There's a lot of different remedies you can do. And like I say, in killing, the worst thing about it is that you could become, you know, take rebirth as a human being again, but you like killing. You like hurting. So we know if people like this, don't we? And that means you're setting yourself up once again. You say, well, I missed the lower realms last time. Of course, you wouldn't even know that. But, hey, you're getting closer to them all the time. So the way to stop behaving like that is to resolve not to behave like that. And finally, there's what they call the fruition and the environment. So the way to stop that is to rely upon your understanding of karmic cause and effect, basically the teachings of the Buddha. Often the reliance here is reliance on the three jewels and bodhicitta. That will stop you taking the rebirth in the lower realms and finding yourselves in these strife-torn environments. Now, Lama Tsongkhapa says, you know, all of us don't want to experience suffering. That's really not the thing that keeps us in cyclic existence. We're here because we like the pleasure it provides. Well, Lama Tsongkhapa says, seeking samsaric pleasures is the door to all suffering. They are uncertain and they cannot be relied upon. Recognizing these shortcomings, please bless you to generate a strong wish for the bliss of liberation. The Gishu Wangal says, though you seek happiness in samsara, you will never find satisfaction. It's like drinking salt water to satisfy thirst. Instead of being satisfied, your attachment will increase and it will become a door to great and long-lasting misery that far outweighs any happiness you actually find. Now, most of us think our problems are coming from, you know, the obvious bad stuff. But actually, it's coming from our craving for the good stuff. That's what keeps us locked in. So we've got to, like, look at what we think is the good stuff. So we get, in other words, we've got to sort of examine what is suffering. So suffering is very obvious to us, what you call suffering of misery, the suffering of pain. And this is the one that's not obvious, suffering of change or the dukkha of change. And finally, just the fact that we are human beings conditioned by causes that are and conditions that are outside of our control means we're going to suffer. It's not going to be as good as it would like to be. So the dukkha of change is what we've really got to look at. And what's being said there is that this thing, right? We go, we thought it would bring happiness and pleasure, but oh no, it doesn't. What's the saying is that you're the objects of your senses and your happiness that is dependent upon them are not by nature true sources of happiness.
I'm just thinking of all the hangovers I've ever had and looking at this going, oh, no, not again.
Yeah. It looked good, but it doesn't provide the good.
It looked great at the time.
Yeah. So we've got to get, you know, when we find ourselves with desirous attachment towards object, we've got to challenge it. And the challenge will naturally arise if you've actually studied this material and reflected back on your own life, how that has been. You know, when you thought drinking would make you happy, when you thought eating these different foods would be great, when you thought this person would be the love of your life, when you thought this car is the car or this house, all these things, and you find it doesn't, that's not true, it doesn't work out like that. So you find that you've done this, again, it's a habit we have, right? Looking at the good and seeing it is good, when in fact it's not. So it's deceptive. And here's an example of it. So I use dukkha and the, so using hunger. So we start off with, we are suffering, we're hungry. That's suffering. We want to do something about it. So we eat some food. And immediately, we get some relief. That relief we call pleasure. We go, oh, good. This is really nice what I'm eating. I feel so much better. So your hunger decreases. Now, if you keep eating, it's not so satisfying. Now suddenly it turns. What was pleasure now is not pleasure. And if you keep eating, a new suffering commences. So it's like everything. Gambling, if you win and you keep going and it just gets worse and worse and worse. Everything, drinking, this is a model for addiction.
It is, but in my mind there is this sneaking thought, it's just because what I ate wasn't good enough. If I got a better thing to eat, it would be better.
Yep, and so then what you could do is try and find all the better things and keep going until you suddenly get it, like it's not better. It's like the same all the time.
Yeah, that's so how many...
You do it, and you put yourself through a great deal of suffering. Like I did it, just like Miffy said. That was my thing. I just moved from object to object to object, thinking, no, that's not it, maybe it's here. No, that's not it, maybe it's here. And I go right out to the edge, you know, and you go, no, that's not it. But then, like, you know, I remember this, talking to Penday Horta. So he said to me, you know, he asked me this question. So he said, you know, What do you think? Do you think your behaviour changes your mind, or do you think you could change your mind and retreat? And I just said, behaviour and experiences change mind. That's how I do it. That's how I've come here. So he didn't say yes or no. He just was quiet. And then I thought about it. I thought, wow, I know people have actually gone into retreat. They didn't do what I did, but they've drawn the same conclusion I finally have. And the suffering I went through to come to that conclusion, you find it's not necessary anymore. It just requires thinking. It requires thinking and reflection. And a decision to be made. You have to decide. It can only give me a limited amount of what we call happiness. It can't actually give me what, you know, I've been seeking, genuine, long-lasting, a sense where, like, you know, you say, well, I don't need to eat anymore. I'm so content. But that doesn't happen.
So, Eddie, with this kind of thinking, then, is that a way to stop the inappropriate attention? Is that actually winding back that inappropriate? Yeah,
so here we go. Next slide, right? So Lama Tsongkhapa says, in response to your question, so led by this pure thought, mindfulness, alertness, and great caution arise. The root of the teachings is keeping the premoksha vows. It is best for you to accomplish this essential practice. So when we say pure thought, the pure here is associated with this renunciation, this drive for freedom. So it's not freedom from obvious suffering. It's also freedom from the suffering of change. That's where it's becoming purified. But what's going to help you keep doing it? It's mindfulness. It's you not forgetting, my God, these behaviors I'm engaging in don't actually provide me with what I'm seeking. I have to do it again. I have to do it again. You know, and then you find yourself at the end of your life on your deathbed and going, what was the point? Because here I am facing death. I'm going to die. No matter how many cream puffs and apple pies I ate, like it's all forgotten. It don't matter. So it's like great caution. Don't get stuck on what you perceive as being the good stuff, the objects of your senses. They can't give you what you're seeking. So the pranimoksha vow, pranimoksha is like the vow of freedom. So if you have laypersons, you have layperson's vows. If you have the ordained, then you have the vows of freedom for the ordained. But to get this freedom that we're seeking, called liberation, right? It means that you have to renounce what doesn't work. You have to give it up. Which leads us to the summary. So what brings us to this idea of freedom? What are the meditations we have to engage in to go, I seek freedom. I want the state of liberation and nirvana. It's the first two truths of the Four Noble Truths. Because it describes in there the deepest levels of suffering we experience as human beings. It's not just, you know, the suffering of misery, obvious pain. It's also the dukkha of change and the dukkha of all-pervasive conditionality. Being a human body, being a human person with the body and the mind of the human ensures your suffering. We're in. There's no avoidance of it. Right? So it's like this describes the deepest levels of the suffering, first two truths. But our motivation is to be free. So what do? We engage in the three higher trainings because that delivers us the freedom that we've been seeking. And another way of looking at this is to say, I engage in the other two truths, the truth of path and the truth of cessation. Because that's what they deliver. Okay, so we're just about on time or just over. I'm not sure because our mic clock's out.
We've got like 2 minutes. I'm still just kind of going wow about the three higher trainings as what can actually deliver us.
Yeah. So if we're seeking, if we're at this middling level of practice, we're seeking our own personal liberation. These are the practices we do. We engage in these three higher trainings to deliver true paths and true cessations. So, what's the takeaway for today? You know these motivations, right, of the small and middling capacity. The small aim is higher realm rebirth, is a human being with leisure and opportunity. Middling capacity is freedom. That's the aim. You know there are things they're trying to avoid. So the beings of the lower scope are trying to avoid lower realm rebirth. The beings of the middling scope are trying to avoid rebirth within psychic existence. You know they're going to have to engage in practices of some sort to bring about those goals they've sought. And we know what those are. They're in the person of lower scope is to avoid the 10 non-virtuous behaviors and to practice the 10 virtuous ones. How do you do it? By taking refuge, obeying the law of karma and its effects. For those of middling capacity, they engage in the three higher trainings to bring about, you know, the true paths and true cessations. And so, well, what actually makes you even think of engaging in these paths? And so, because I understand true sufferings and true origins, I understand the depth of my own suffering, and I know I can be free of it. If you couldn't be free of it, we'd just leave it alone. Don't even think about the stuff or either, but it'd be terrible. But because there is a way out, it's like with refuge, we're saying, I'm accepting the big view that you're giving me here about suffering and its causes, but I'm really also convinced I could be free of it. And so we take refuge in understanding what suffering is at its origins. We accept that, but we also have conviction that we can be free of it. So we do what we can to be free of it, which in this case was three higher trainings.
So, Eddie, it's quite a balancing act, isn't it, to kind of let yourself contemplate the enormity of the suffering and at the same time not collapse but remember the confidence we can do something about it and not just kind of like plaster it over and go, well, it doesn't matter or it's all okay, but actually take both of those on board.
So in a way, one of the ways of taking these things on board is to find a simile or a metaphor to throw it up against. Now, so one of the ones that I find very useful is the idea to find yourself in prison. But that's like that samsara, right? But if you ask yourself, well, why am I in prison? Yeah, well, the answer is going to be, well, I did something I shouldn't have done, and I got caught, and now I find myself in jail. So there are causes for you to experience the suffering of being in jail.
Right, Lama Geshe says,
it's not my fault. They blame everything else, right? But the fact is, you did something. You got caught. So karma catches you. Now you get the effect. You're in jail. Right? So while you're in jail, you know, just above the walls there, there's freedom. Right? Your thing is in jail. It's like, how do I get back out there? What do I have to do? Well, so you have to be a good boy, Eddie. And you cannot... If we think you're going to engage in those behaviors again, we'll keep you here. So you've got to sort of stop doing what you used to do. And you have to do something else. And then the parole board will look at you favorably and say, oh, I think we'll give you another chance. Right? So you can get out. We try and find things like that. So these events take place in your life all the time. It's just a way of contrast, putting them up against one another.
That's a great example, Eddie, because there are, you know, there's so many movies of people who do find themselves in prison and then really work incredibly hard to get out and then to help their fellow, inmates as well in whatever way they can. So, I mean, that does happen, but most of them are just going, it wasn't me, I didn't do it.
Yeah, that's right. The other analogy you can use is the medical analogy. Yeah, like say you find yourself with cancer, you find yourself sick, right? Well, there are causes for that. You head off to the doctor, you tell them all about, they do a diagnosis, and then they suggest something you should do. So, you know, then you go off and you go, well, I could be free of my cancer. Is it a possibility? But to do it, I've got to do these other things. I've got to stop doing what I used to do and do these new things. And you give it a shot. You know, and you're aiming it to be free from the cancer. But it's the same sort of thing here. You know, so you know of these different motivations, aims, and practices. And you also know the meditations that you need to engage in to bring about the different types of elimination. So what I'd like you to do is try and become familiar with it. And but if you forget, you can always come back up online and look at these slides and go, oh, there it is. Or look at your notes. So between now and next week, there is this chart again, once again, in the members area. Have a little look at it because, again, we'll be talking about this scope or next scope. Here's some material to look at, pages 21 to 22 of the FPMT notes, pages 15 to 26 the LTC excerpts. And today we've answered 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 5, 6, 8. We've answered 9 questions of these 2 different review exams. So like I said, try to memorize these 2 stages. Right? There's only 3 things in each. It's pretty straightforward. And lastly, next week, we're going to be looking at the great scope, the practices of bodhicitta and the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others. And this is contained in verses 7 to 14. So we've come to the end, and I want to dedicate now the efforts you've put in to remain, to even come to class, to engage in it, to study. May it all go well for you so you can bring about a sense of renunciation to cyclic existence. So, dedicating, this is the great bodhisattvas that have done in the past. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. And may the supreme jewel, bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. And may that born have no decline but increase forevermore. That as long as space abides and as long as we abide, may we do the very best we can to help any other sentient being that remains. Okay, guys, thank you very much for being here. Thank you for engaging. And hope it's all worthwhile for you. Yeah, do the best you can. Try to have a happy mind while we go through the weeks. It's not easy, but do the best you can and stay alive for next week.